Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Patentability of Business Methods Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 28, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Bilski v. Kapos. The question in this case was whether a process must be tied to a particular machine or apparatus or transform a particular article into a different state or thing in order to be eligible for patenting under 35 U.S.C. Section 101. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kennedy, the Supreme Court held that although business methods are patentable as a general matter, the particular patent at issue in this case was an unpatentable abstract idea precluded from patentability by the court's precedents. To discuss the case, we have University of Chicago Law School and New York University Law School Professor Richard A. Epstein, who signed an amicus brief in support of the petitioner. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Hi, this is Richard Epstein speaking from the University of Chicago Law School. I'm here today to talk about a case which has attracted some degree of attention and a great deal of apprehension in the law of intellectual property. It's a case called Bilski against Kapos. Bilski is the inventor, in this particular case, of a complex sort of mathematical program which is designed to allow people to insulate themselves from certain kinds of financial shocks. And on the other side, Kapos is the head of the Patent and Trade Office. The case makes its way to the Supreme Court because the Patent Office refused to allow the patentability of the particular patent, that invention that had been proposed by our friend Bilski. And the question was whether or not he was or was not in the scope of the patent law. In order to understand this, what one has to do is to realize that the patent statute has basically two key tests for figuring out whether or not you're going to grant an individual patent. The first one goes to something known as patent eligibility. And the question that you ask under Section 101 of the statute is whether or not somebody has put forward any new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement thereon. And if you listen to the sort of four words on the list, process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, they all seem to have a relatively strong physicalist background. You think of something tangible in machines and manufactures and processes of purifying chemicals and so forth. But with the information age, the question is whether or not you can develop some way to make sure that the law of patents keeps up with the transformations in policy and transformations in technology. And Bilski presents this question as to whether or not this particular business method patent is in fact going to be eligible for the protection that the law does. The second thing that one worries about, typically in an ordinary patent case, is whether or not you can say that the particular patent, which is a machine manufacturer composition of matter, is non-obvious to somebody who's skilled in the trade of art to which it pertains. And in this particular case, it was easily possible for one to say, you know, we've looked at the thing that Mr. Bilski has postponed, and we don't think that it's all that it's cracked up to be. It's kind of easy for anybody who knows something about the business to put together a simple algorithm. And if, in fact, you want to say that that's what it is, a non-obvious type situation, it's a case-by-case determination, and nobody will get very upset about it. But if, on the other hand, you say, aha, we have this broad class of patents known as business method patents, and these are all patent ineligible, such that you can't even get to first base on them, then, in effect, you're going to send tremors through the entire sort of information industries, which are heavily dependent upon patent protection. In this particular case, Scott Keefe and myself wrote a brief on behalf of a man named Ananda Chakrabarty, who in 1980 won a very much a landmark case against the Patent Office, in effect saying that his sort of microbes, which could eat oil, all too relevant today, I'm sorry to say, were to be patent eligible or whether they were to be excluded on the grounds that they were somehow living things. And the Supreme Court there took a very broad definition of patentability, covering essentially anything under the sun. The theory that people had in this particular case was that if all business method patents were in the public domain, a huge mode for commercial exploitation would no longer be available. And things got worse, in my view, at least in the Federal Circuit, which is charged with having the appellate jurisdiction over all patent types of disputes, when they adopted a so-called machine and transformation test, which sort of indicated that you really have to have a physical substrate at every stage in the process in order to be patent eligible, at which point this particular patent would simply disappear from the face of the globe. So when the Supreme Court took certiorari on it, the stakes were thought to be extremely high. Would you have all information technologies bereft of patent protection, at least in the financial sector and perhaps beyond, having to do such things as medical devices and the like? Or would the patent law continue on its relatively protective path, which it had taken starting in 1980 in the case that I just mentioned involving Mr. Chakrabarty? Well, it turns out that basically what happened is the Supreme Court sort of split the difference. If you were Mr. Bielski and worried about your patent, you'd be very sad today because they declared that his particular patent was patent ineligible. But if you're somebody who's trying to worry about the long-term structure of information industries and the financial sector, this case will turn out to be pretty much a non-event because of the deus ex machina, the god out of the machine. That's not a patentable machine, it's an intellectual machine that came forward in this case. What the Supreme Court essentially did is it looked at this particular patent and it said, you know, we are most unimpressed by it. We really think it's nothing more than a mathematical formula or abstraction. So instead of worrying about the question of whether or not this particular invention was a patent eligible and then non-obvious, what it says is there's another doctrine out there which applies, and that's the doctrine which you cannot patent laws of nature's mathematical ideas or various kinds of substances that appear in natural form. And what the Supreme Court did, it said this is just a plain old ordinary abstract idea. And if it's just a kind of a mathematical formula, you don't even get to the patent eligible stage, and you don't have to worry, therefore, about the non-obvious stage and the way in which this thing is going to play out. And so what happens is this fellow starts to leave and loses his case, but the basic structure of the law remains. Or does it, one would ask. One of the things that's striking about this particular decision that's worth at least a second or two of comment is as follows. Why did the court take up the mathematical abstraction question at the Supreme Court level when it hadn't been raised below? Another thing that it could have done was to simply say, look, we think that business method patents are a perfectly useful and viable form, but you still have this question about mathematical abstractions on the other end of it, and what we'd like to do is to have a lower court pass on this thing first before we decided to make an authoritative determination. But they didn't do that. So in some sense, what's going to happen now is we're going to have that first stage, mathematical abstraction versus patent eligibility, come more into play. It's not going to destroy the entire class of business method patents because, in fact, what the Supreme Court did through Justice Kennedy in his argument was essentially to, first of all, basically deconstruct and reject both on statutory language and on policy grounds everything that the Federal Circuit said in its rather far-reaching opinion that it was going to overrule its earliest precedent, a case called State Street from 1998, and get rid of the entire class of these sort of business method patents. And it said you can't do this in the modern age when so much of the world is embedded in information. What you have to do is to have process and manufacture and composition of matter and machines all adjusted to take into account this new and permanent kind of intellectual reality. So overall, what's going to happen is there will be probably a slight truncation of the law as a consequence of this case and a renewed attention to the abstract formula versus patent eligibility issue, but there will be no major change in this area. Now, to set this thing into its larger context, let me just end with the following observation. There have been a large number of Supreme Court cases in the patent areas, and I'm happy to say that I've written amicus briefs in most of them, usually on the losing side. And the basic sort of direction that had taken place prior to this case was one in which the Supreme Court was increasingly restive with respect to the high level of protection that the Federal Circuit in a previous incarnation had given to various kinds of patents. The two most notable cases in this particular line are first a case called eBay, in which the Supreme Court intimated that you were not automatically entitled to an injunction simply because somebody practiced your patent, but there would be a complicated kind of equitable balancing test to do with it. Lower court cases since then have tended to go back to the traditional rule that if there's a violation of a patent that's either patented or licensed, you can get an injunction pretty much, of course, but the Supreme Court rule was a little bit squishier than that. It remains to be seen when they're going to get back into this issue or whether they get back into it at all. And there was another case called Quanta against LG in which the question was the extent to which you can enforce a patent against people who would acquire their particular devices under a license from somebody who had used your patented technology. And the Supreme Court gave, again, a narrow interpretation of the reach of your patents against licensees of your own licensees, sub-licensees, as it were, or assignees. And I thought that was also a mistake. So the largest significance is that we may have reached the end of the period at which the Supreme Court has decided that cutting back on patents is sound social policy, and we may enter into a period of consolidation at an equilibrium which I think to be somewhat less than ideal, but which nonetheless seems to be tolerably serviceable. So the reaction that one has off of this opinion by Justice Kennedy and the various concurrences and so forth is not one of exultation, but it is certainly one, in my case, of a great deal of relief. We're going to have more stuff on patents. The area is simply too important. But at least for the moment, all is quiet on the patent front.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.